Mr. Gibson, Reel 4. We're on the journey on the second troop ship, Mr. Gibson. What route did you follow?
Well, from Avonmouth, we sailed up the Irish Sea and went back to Gourock in the Firth of Clyde. From then, we went up into the North Atlantic and we hit some really bad weather. I was in charge of the Bren guns, which were stationed in little boxes up on the decks, and at times the wind was so strong that when I was taking their coffee to them, I had to pull myself by the rails along the deck to reach them. After a few days, we were surprised to be met by a magnificent sight. It seemed that the whole of the US Navy was come to meet us. There were aircraft carriers, cruisers, destroyers, planes which flew overhead and dropped parcels upon our deck, and our small escort of British ships left us, and from then on these American ships escorted us until we reached Nova Scotia. And what a magnificent sight it was, sailing up to Halifax, up the harbour there. It was a beautiful sight, beautiful day.
Can I just ask what date of time this was? Because Japan still hadn't come into the war, had it?
Japan was not in the war, no. Two things surprised us. One was to see more American ships there, and the next was night time. We had been used to blackout for a long, long time in England, and to see the whole of Halifax and all the ships in the harbour and the reflections of the lights, it was truly an amazing sight. What surprised us then was that we all disembarked from our old English ship and we were marched onto these beautifully painted American ships. And I was put onto the Joseph T. Dickman, which was one of five ships. We then sailed south, and after a few days the weather got warmer and warmer and we became browner and browner until we reached Trinidad, Puerto de España, port of Spain, where we spent a couple of days there, but we weren't allowed ashore. The Americans did, and some of them did not return. They were knifed.
Oh, there was that kind of problem, wasn't it?
Two or three of them, yes. And a few days later, which was on the 23rd of November, we crossed the equator. And the crossing of the equator was a magnificent affair for the Americans. They all dressed up. We all had to become, we were all polywogs in their eyes. And after you crossed the equator, after the initiation, you became shellbacks.
And what was the initiation ceremony?
The initiation ceremony, there was a huge tank of water filled up, and along the top there was the King Neptune and Davy Jones and an array of Americans dressed up, and everyone who was a polywog had a parade in front. He had his hair cut, mustaches were halved sometimes, beards were cut, everyone was shaved with plenty of lather, and then we were ducked into this huge pond. Of course, there were some people who didn't fancy this idea, especially one Irish lad, Egan. It took 3 days to find him.
Was it the water deep? What about non-swimmers?
I was a non-swimmer, and after I got in there and they were ducking me a few times, I had to shout and tell them I couldn't swim, and they pushed me towards the lake. Right. After crossing the line, we sailed across the Atlantic Ocean towards Cape Town. But we were chased by submarines and we went further south and hit really bad weather south of the Cape. And on the 7th of December, the whole attitude of the Americans changed because they heard that Pearl Harbor had occurred. And whereas they had been quite carefree, some of them were reduced to tears. And on the 9th of December, we sailed into Cape Town, and another beautiful sight seeing Cape Town and knowing that we were going to ashore.
Before we go on that, what were conditions like on the American ship compared to the British ship?
Oh, all the difference in the world. We weren't in hammocks. We were on proper little beds, which were on hinges, which swiveled down. There was marvellous food on trays, which we hadn't been used to. And they had a terrific canteen, well stocked. The only trouble was, with a thousand of us and one small canteen, that was hardly enough for the crew themselves to line up. The thing that surprised us, all these American sailors, great big chaps, who line up, and what were they wanting? Ice cream. And of course, our lads wanted to go to... But it was arranged that only one person per mess deck should collect. No one else volunteered except yours truly. And my job then was to go around and ask everyone what they wanted at the canteen, to make a list of it, to total it up, and then go down to the canteen and collect. Someone would say, I want 20 Camel cigarettes, someone would say 40 Philip Morris cigarettes, etc. I would collect the money in cents and dollars. Then I would go and collect a huge bag of the stuff and bring it back. And what I found out was that I was buying it from them in bulk. And so I was becoming an entrepreneur. I was always left every day with quite a few dollars more than I'd taken in, you see. Because I was buying the thing in cartons where they were buying them in 20s, you see. So I was building up quite a collection of dollars, and I asked the sergeant major what I should do with it, and he just looked at me and said, who volunteered for the job? So I was collecting this money on the way.
What other things were you getting? You said, you know, food that you hadn't had in England.
Well, for instance, I didn't know what fresh figs were like. And, of course, we were on their ship when they had Thanksgiving Day. We were on their ship for Christmas dinner. And their portions, you just held your tray and they would keep putting it on. In fact, our colonel, he complained. He said we were being spoiled.
Were the Americans curious about, you know, what conditions in England and when you were talking to them?
Oh, yes. They tried to entertain us, of course, and they thought they were doing us a favour by producing two English films. One was The Prisoner of Zenda, with Ronald Coleman and Madeleine Carroll and David Niven people, and Douglas Fairbanks. The other was Pygmalion. And they were so curious, when we were watching this film, for instance, of Pygmalion, where Eliza went to tea, they would bring cups and saucers onto deck and say, now, how do you have afternoon tea? What do you do with your saucer and your plate? And how do you hold your cup?
Quite incredible, isn't it?
Yes, and they used to have boxing matches and wrestling matches. And, of course, on the Joseph T. Dickman, there were quite a number of coloured sailors, and some of them were golden glove boxers, and they were very good boxers indeed, and they used to give exhibitions.
Did any of the anti-coloured feeling between the whites and the blacks show on board the ship with the crew?
You've hit upon something there, because my first night on an American ship, the lad said, bring your banjo up on deck. and we'll have a sing song. I started playing, the lights went low, and I didn't take any notice, I was concentrating, until I looked up and found that there wasn't one white person there, and I was surrounded by all the members of the black crew who were listening intently and watching my fingers. Now, not having been with any black people before, I was very, very embarrassed. Now, now I would have said to some of them, do you play, and handed the banjo over to them, but I just was so embarrassed, I just picked up my banjo and walked away. But they were really interested in the music.
Did you have duties on board this ship?
Well, I took over that duty, and there were no duties for the others. Some helped in the galley, and some helped throwing over the rubbish at night time. We got used to the Americans and their orders, darken ship and secure from close quarters. And every night we gathered on deck to watch the sun go down. And that was when the orderly officer, the American, would appear on the above the aft deck, and all the rubbish from the day would be there. And we're waiting for the sun to go down before Visaki, who was always in trouble, he had Visaki written on the back of his doughboy hat, would say, "What shall I do with these boxes, Chief?" And the Chief would say, "Throw them overboard, Visaki." And we would all help to throw the rubbish overboard.
Prior to Japan bombing Pearl Harbor, they would know you people might have been going into action somewhere.
Oh,
so
yes.
Did this show in their attitude towards you?
Oh, yes. They realized we were going into war and they were out of it. But that's when their attitude changed after Pearl Harbor, because they were in it just the same as us.
You got to South Africa. What was the welcome like there when you got ashore?
Well, it was terrific, because we were hardly off the ship, about five of us together, when a huge car pulled up. And the gentleman got out of the car and said, "Are you from England?" We said, "Yes." He said, "My wife was from Nottingham. She would love to meet someone like you from England. Would you mind coming with me?" And we got in his car, and he took us to a beautiful bungalow, and we met his wife, who was from Nottingham. And she was a widow, because her husband had been a fighter pilot and had died, or had been killed. And she was overwhelmed to hear what was happening in England. And she invited us back the next day, and she said, "Would you like a trip?" And they took us by car halfway up Table Mountain. And it was a terrific experience, looking down on the harbour and seeing all our ships down there at sea.
How long were you ashore?
We were ashore for 4 days.
Did you get, a look at apartheid at work?
Yes.
As it came to call?
Yes, because everywhere there was whites only, you see, and we knew the blacks were hanging about on the dockside, and if you threw coins down, they would scramble for them.
Did this shock you in any way, this treatment of other people?
It certainly surprised us. Especially as we'd been on the ship, working with coloureds on the ships.
And the other 4 or 5 days, or what were you doing in those days?
Mostly with this gentleman taking us round.
Was the lady in white singing as you came into harbour, which happened with some British troop ships at the
time? Well, we never encountered her, no. I don't know whether she was at Durban or...
I think you're right. Yes, I think it was Durban. And at this time, or about this time, you still didn't know where you were going.
No.
They hadn't told you.
No.
But I think you said you thought you were going to the Middle East.
Yes, we had all the equipment for Middle East. And as I've said before, one of our officers was teaching us, or trying to teach us, Arabic, which made us fairly sure that we were heading for North Africa.
After 5 days, you reboarded your ship?
Yes, yes. And of course, from then on, instead of having all this, half of the American fleet escorting us, we just had one ship, one cruiser. And it took us across the Indian Ocean. The Americans, when they saw we only had one ship after the escort that we'd been used to, but we said, the Americans, it's all right, this one ship will do just the same as the others.
How were you becoming acclimatized to the changing conditions, the heat?
It happened so gradually. In fact, one of our chaps, Sergeant Kingsnorth, he would have passed for a Sikh or a Punjabi.
Had no problems with heat, no, exhaust, no, you know. So it would be quite a healthy trip, really, for you.
Oh, yes, we
with the food and everything.
I spent all my nights on deck. I never slept below when the weather was suitable.
And did you have things like boat drills and
yes,
deck inspections?
Boat drills, PE, deck inspections, kit inspections, etc., went on as usual.
And presumably, of course, although you're an American ship, you're still British troops under British command.
Yes.
It was the whole of 125 on the ship.
The whole of 125 was on the ship, yes. And we came under American discipline as well. Yeah, I was telling you about Vasaki throwing off one of my friends. He was always a bit of a jester. He came up and went on where the orderly officer, the American orderly officer should be, and he shouted the American orderly officer's commands, and Vasaki said, "What shall I do with these boxes, chief?" And he imitated the Americans and said, "Throw them overboard, Vasaki." And as he was doing this, the American officer came round and caught him at it, and he spent a few days in the brig.
What was his name?
We call him Jester Conlon. Red Conlon. Of course, they organised concerts as well on board the ship, and Jester Conlon and Carney, they were comedians and took part.
So, essentially, you got on very well with the American crew.
Very, very well indeed, yes.
How long was your journey? I mean, you must have been at sea quite a while by now.
Yes, I mean, considering we left, what, October the 28th, and we didn't arrive in Bombay until January the 1st. No, New Year's Eve, December the 31st, we arrived in Bombay. So that was from October the 28th to December the 31st.
And you celebrate Christmas on board?
Christmas Day on board American ship. Marvellous feast, marvellous party.
Served by the officers as was traditional?
Yes, yes. Well, except that on the American ship we got used to this tray service where there were compartments. Your meat went in one, your vegetables went in different ones, your sweet went into another one, and you just carried that to your mess deck. But the officers did come down, yes.
So you said you arrived in Bombay, well, you know then you weren't going to the Middle East, of course.
Oh, yes.
You still hadn't told you where you were going.
No, no. Arrived in Bombay New Year's Eve, and I spent New Year's Eve on the waterfront in Bombay. The same five of us that spent the time together in Cape Town, we were there at night time. Beautiful weather, you know, night time. nice and warm. We were looking, we should have a party or a dance for New Year's Eve. And we heard music, and we hurried towards this music. And it was a huge dance hall called Greens. And the music we heard was the Lambeth Walk. And we thought, oh great, we'll be able to have a dance. And when we looked into this huge dance hall, there were American sailors dancing with British soldiers with American hats on, American sailors with British hats on, and not one woman in sight. And the Indian band had to play Lambeth Walk over and over again while our lads taught the Americans how to do the Lambeth Walk. That was our party in Bombay.
What were your initial reaction to Indian Indians?
We were fascinated. Yes. I mean, the noise, the people, the traffic, and the buildings that were going on. We were fascinated to see. They didn't have proper scaffold. They had bamboo poles tied together. And there were people, you know, way up in the sky on the top of bamboo poles making these terrific buildings. And another thing that we were amazed at night time, the number of people sleeping on the pavement and sleeping in doorways, even some with their own little beds sleeping outside. And of course the beggars. We were being constantly chased by women and men, but mainly by women with babies in their arms shouting "Bakshish, Saab, Bakshish." Terrible sight.
Were you there long?
Just a few days.
And still on the ship?
No, we'd left the ship then. Yes.
Where did you go to when you left the ship?
From there, we went on by train to a place called Ahmednagar. And that was on the 1st of January. So we're really in Bombay just one full day. And on the 1st of January, we set off for Ahmednagar on these trains. And we were fascinated by the countryside, of course, and seeing other trains packed with Indian people. But it wasn't a very comfortable train, mainly wood rails. And although it was fascinating to see, it wasn't very comfortable.
They're pretty primitive, the train.
Oh, they were, yes.
And how long were you on? How long was the journey?
Just a few days. Well, the one day, really.
And you then get to this camp, this...
Ahmednagar. It was a really big military camp.
And what are your memories of it?
Well, first of all, we would get up 6 o'clock in the morning and do PE in shorts and be freezing. 2 hours later, we would be in our full uniform and absolutely sweating. When we were on parade. Of course, we had very big, light and airy billets, and with beds. For the first time in the army, we were having beds to sleep in, with mosquito nets. And we all managed to have a bearer for about one anna per day. 16 annas were 1 rupee, so we could have someone to clean our kits and keep our topis nice and clean and our equipment clean for roughly 1 penny per day.
And did these people shave you?
Well, no, I didn't like to be shaved, but I like to shave myself. Yes.
And they were attached to you, and obviously they carried out these tasks.
They weren't attached to us. They used to come from the village nearby and beg for the job.
Did you have the Indian gentleman that was wafting the air?
not in ours, But outside, there were always Indian gentlemen there. You could go out 2, 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, and in the dark, someone would say, Char Sahib. Someone would be there waiting for the opportunity to take one anna from you for a cup of cha, and that would be his livelihood. While we were there, we were entertained by a man known as Professor Balapastar, and I think we paid 4 annas to go. And the majority of our officers and quite a number of our men paid the 4 annas to see this man, and I've never known such an amazing man in all my life. He started off with a huge piece of iron bar, and he put it in his mouth, into his teeth, and bent it. Now, we didn't think much of that. We thought, oh, that would be a bit soft iron. And he threw it onto the wooden platform stage, and such a crash it went. We realised it was a... He got a longer piece of iron, put it against his Adam's apple, and had 5 sergeants holding a trestle table, and he pushed them off the edge of the stage. He died. He said he was going to die, and he asked the MO to test him. And of course the MO went up and tested and said, for all intents and purposes, this man is dead. And then at the given time, he woke up. He asked Sergeant Allen to come onto the stage, and he put a dish on his head with some rice and water in, and he put a piece of wire from his dish to his mouth. And a few minutes later, Sergeant Allen said, oh, it's hot, it's hot, it's hot. And when he took this down, I was on the front row, and I put my fingers in, and nearly scalded my fingers. He cooked the rice on that sergeant's head. Another thing he did, he had a bow and arrow, and although he was blinded, he was hitting targets around the room. He asked who was the senior officer in the room, and it was our Colonel Dean, and they swung a wreath of flowers round in a circle, suspended by one thread, and although he was blinded, and they turned him round, he fired this arrow. It pierced the one thread, and the wreath of flowers landed over Colonel Dean's head. I've never known anything like it in all my life. And all that was for 4 annas, 4 pence.
So you obviously had quite a bit of leisure. What about sport? And
sport, well, our regiment, mainly Sunderland lads, and they were mad keen on football. And the division, while we were there, had a competition. And our regiment got into the final and won the competition for the whole division. And a very good friend of mine was the goalkeeper. And unfortunately, they didn't have grass pitches. It was all hard rubber. He scraped his leg in diving, and it festered, and he was left behind. Now, how lucky was he? At the time, he was very unlucky. He wanted to stay with the regiment, but at least he didn't become a prisoner of war.
How did British troops, that you saw in general, treat the native population?
Well, I think we spoiled them. You know, the fellas who'd been out there for years said, you shouldn't be giving them so much money, you shouldn't be treating them so well, you're spoiling it.